I'm really, Quinn, you left the city. And here's the thing you need to know about me. I'm a dating girl now. I go
You
on
go on
dates.
dates.
I go on dates. It's a whole new thing for me. I gotta tell you,
How many dates have you been on since I last saw you?
so far two, but I started last week and I have like three more this week.
Great.
I'm really going for it in a way.
It's the
Pretty
only way to
intense.
do it,
It's the
honestly,
only way to do it.
because it's a numbers game, so you have to play the numbers. And playing the numbers means getting out there and being like, wait, maybe I can be picky because it turns out there's a lot of people.
This is helpful. Well, what happened was this is all new. This is a new world. I've been going to the beach every weekend and it's been really nice. And I'm dying to hear about how Denver is. I've been going to the beach every weekend and I have to turn my focus off. And the other weekend I was with another single gal pal and I was like, I think I need to change my profile. So I have had Hinge for a while and it's been on and again, off again. Because of my history. And I hadn't updated the pictures for years, or my settings for years. And so I was like, what's going on there? So I went and I updated all the pictures. So they're all from the last year, which is, I think, good.
Yeah,
You should do that,
smart.
I think. Smart. It felt bad. Scrolling through photos of yourself, being like,
What
what
do
do
I
I want?
pick?
Awful.
What represents me?
I have to give a shout out to my friend Jane, who like held my hand and had me just going, what about this one? What about this one? What about this one? And then I went and looked at the settings, and the settings I had that I had not updated for years was that the oldest age that could find me was 36 years old, which is how old I am. And which was like stupid, really stupid. So then I changed that setting and it's
How
okay.
old did you go?
Well, here's the thing.
45.
At first I said, here's my age, and I was like, no deal breaker. So then I was getting like 60-year-olds liking me and 19-year-olds liking me, and I was like, ah, like
You're
a
like, I
fun.
gotta narrow the scope
I
here.
gotta narrow
I
the
would
scope.
do 32 to 45.
Okay, so the two dates that I've gone on, 45 plus.
Oh.
I'm going out with another guy tonight who in the East Village. I'm really going hard.
I think it's so smart, and I'm
Thank
really
you.
proud of you. And I
Thank
think, like,
you.
it's only gonna be like
It's only
a
more
confidence
information.
booster, and yes, more information.
Yeah.
And it's just like I said, it's a numbers game. If you're not playing the numbers, you're not gonna win. So
Exactly. Tell me, how's Denver?
Denver's great. I got to be with so many babies on this trip. Brianna has a lot of babies that are very cute and funny. Her babies are so
They
cute.
are really. She just sent me a picture because I met someone on the app who's like, I think I know you through Brianna. And I texted Brianna and I was like, what's the deal with this guy? And she said, I don't see you with him.
Okay.
Helpful. And she's a witch, so I do listen to her in that way.
That's accurate.
But they're so cute.
They're so cute. They're like totally funny, totally different personalities. No way to. And it was cute watching, like, my kids were really into them. And Koa would be like, you know, I do like George. I do like Trent the best. He would tell, like, Brianna and Josh that. And they'd be like, oh, really? Why? And he'd be like, I feel that I matter to him more. Sometimes I go up to George and he doesn't really seem to care about me at all. But Trent really cares about me. He seems to really like me, so I like him.
Do you think, honestly, that's how I'm dating. I just like, if, do you
Yes.
like me? Then I like you. Do you think also that because Trent Quinlan's your favorite, right?
I mean, he's named for me,
He's named
but
for it, so
meeting
it's hard.
George is pretty great. Like, it's hard to not just be in love with both of them. And then Whitney's here right now with her adorable, enormous, hilarious baby, Bryson, who is so cute, and he just started taking his first steps here.
my gosh, everybody was together.
Yeah.
How does Griffin like being a little bit older than all the babies?
He doesn't. He was okay with the babies because they just lie on the ground. Bryson is 10 months, so Bryson's crawling around touching right. shit. And he's like, Bryson's ruining my stuff. And he's taking my stuff. And I'm like, none of this is your stuff. Like, this is, like, we don't live here. And
but he's a prince, Quinn.
He gets really mad and is like, Bryson, no. And then Whitney and I have to be like, Bryson's a baby. We know he's as big as you, but he's a baby.
He's the same size as Griff.
And Bryson's so cute. He got his head stuck in a chair yesterday. He put it in sideways through like the arm and the sit down part. And then he turned and then he was stuck in it. And Whitney couldn't figure out how to get him out. And she had like a panic attack and was like calling my parents. And they had to pull him through the other way to get him out.
Poor guy. Poor Whitney.
I know.
He won't remember. He's not. He might. What if we find out that Bryson like later in life has like a fear of chairs?
Chairs. He won't sit.
He won't sit. He's standing. He's standing or squatting, but that guy won't sit anywhere. It's crazy. Yeah. What other fun activities have you done?
We went to REI yesterday because there's a playground inside it. My kids played yes. in there. And there's like this little area of creek called, can't remember what it's called. Confluence Park. And it's this little area of almost like a mini rapids. And we bring an inner tube and the kids go down it over and over again, kind of like a little free ride.
That's so fun.
But the funnest thing we've done, my favorite thing that we've did is we went to Casa Bonita, which
you love. It's owned now by the South Park
Trey
guys,
Parker
right?
and Matt Stone bought it. And
which now is
if
the
you guys are
them.
Curious, please. They're so broke. They just did. Like
I'm
a
worried for them. It's $1.5 billion. It's tough. It's
but like. Here's they're exciting. Billionaires. That's
they're
so
billionaires,
crazy.
But also, I love that they're. I love how they're using their power right now.
Yes,
I think they're
well,
using their power in such a good way.
You should watch the movie, the documentary, Casa Bonita Mi Amor. I think is
what
it's
told
called.
Me about it.
We just watched it this right before going. We watched it the night before, and it's all about Casa Bonita's history and them buying it and them being like. We love this place and it's like after COVID, it was really going to go under and they were like, not on our watch. And so they bought it. And especially I think Trey Parker, it's like it meant the world to him as like a 7-year-old. And he's like, I'm not like for 7-year-olds everywhere. I will make this place be okay. I don't care how much we have to spend. We're willing to spend $6-7 million to like get this place back to where it needs to be. And then they hire all these people to come in and check out Casa Bonita. For those of you that don't know, it's a Mexican restaurant inside of a pink castle on a strip mall that you pay for a Mexican meal to get in. Then you are served that meal. Then you are served free sopapillas, which is fried dough with honey. Then you can explore the grounds, which include a wishing well, a haunted cave, a tarot reader, cliff divers that are happening while you're eating. Just it is like the most unhinged wonderland and none of it makes sense and all of it's great and there's like a guy in a gorilla suit running around. It just like it's really
chaos.
Feels like you're in a fever dream and I loved it growing up and to go back and have had them save it was like thank you so much for this to get to see my kids here was magic. But what's interesting is when they went in they were like so where do the divers come out of the pool and they're like here. Once they dive in they swim through this tiny hole in the ground and they come up in this room with all this electric equipment and they're like oh and no one's died. It's like it just made no sense. And then they take apart the air ducts in the place and that they're filled with like black mold and dust in this way that's like we can't use these. They all have to be redone. And then they're like, when this was built a million years ago, it was already not up to code. Now it is the most dangerous place in the world. And they have been fixing it by like there was a leak in one of the pipes. And once they got into the ceiling, the way that it had been fixed was they had put a bucket underneath it and then put a hose in the bucket that let the water outside the restaurant. Like it was just like Band-Aid, Band-Aid, Band-Aid.
People are so creative. People are so creative.
So creative when they don't want to spend money. So yeah. The $6-7 million, I will tell you that the final price tag on fixing Casa Bonita was $40 million. Isn't that crazy?
Wait, how is it that
40
big?
Million. It's that big and that beautiful.
Oh, that sounds so fun. Did the kids love it?
They loved it. They loved it.
You guys always go on such fun adventures.
We really do.
When are you back?
We live for the adventure. In a week.
Do you know where I'm going on Thursday? I'm going with Brayden, Spencer, and Adam to Clueless at Fort Greene Park.
Oh, that'll be so fun. Why is it at Fort Greene Park? That's confusing.
It's just an outdoor. It's an outdoor movie.
Oh, I was like, the play? Which I would totally love.
It's Shakespeare in the Park. Clueless. I would fucking go ham for it.
What if it was great is that, though?
That would be fucking incredible. Yeah, no. I'm trying to think if there's any fun updates besides me getting back out into the world. Wow.
You're going this Thursday to that?
Yeah.
Oh, I can't wait. That's really fun. I love Clueless.
I do, too. And I'm going on a date right before.
Great.
Quinn.
Why not?
I just need... You have my location. So just... Every now and then, just be like,
give a check. Give a check, see.
Is Carrie safe?
I know that you do enough true crime to make good decisions.
Quinn, you say that.
Oh, I do want to tell you one other really funny thing, which is that we went to Boulder, Colorado, the other day, and we went to like the Duchambe Tea House, which is this like really cool tea house that Duchambe Tajikistan gave Boulder, and Boulder gave them like a language school. It's like friendship between Boulder and Duchambe, and you're like, why? I don't know how it happened, but I love it. And from there we were like walking through Pearl Street Mall, this like outdoor mall, and there was musicians, and this guy's playing the saxophone, and Matt gives Griff a dollar, and Griff's like, what do I do with it? And he's like, go put it where he has money. And the musician had like an open case in front of him with a bunch of dollar bills in it, and Griff walks up to him and put the dollar bill in his saxophone. Do you die?
Can I tell you, I miss him. I miss him.
Here you go, sir.
Like, I miss him.
Sort of
I
like, shh, be quiet. Like, feels so rude. It's like,
I really like him.
I know, me too. He's really funny and really anxious. And I really love living with him.
Is it kind of like, is it you? Are you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He's like mini me for sure.
He's very funny and very anxious, which actually, same. Same.
Totally.
Samesies.
Should we do some stories?
Oh, you're listening to Truly.
Darkly.
Creeply. And we have Patreons. It's time for Patreons. We got a couple Patreons to sing. Hey, hey.
April, join she will. Patreon is now something that she's getting every month. Are you jealous?
Are you excited? April, we are so excited for you. April.
April showers bring wallet flowers in the form of money. Thank you.
If you didn't understand that wallet flowers meant money, I'm concerned. Thank you for explaining, Quinn. Okay.
I think I over-explained it.
Which means she explained too much. Next.
Heather.
Heather in the winds, you are such a star. We love you. We go very far. Heather, you are a joy to behold. Let's go and not get a cold.
Heather, do you wear leather? I think you should.
Not suede, because that stains in the rain.
Shelly.
Shelly, you're so swelly. I feel like I've made up that rhyme so many times. Shelly, you are gonna enjoy the
world.
The world. Shelly, I'm hungover, and I hope you're not, but if you are, I hope you feel better.
If you're jelly of Shelly, join Patreon. Shelly, what the helly? What's that song? We're so sorry, Shelly.
Okay, I need your opinion on something.
Mm.
I think I've been avoiding telling people I'm on the dating app that I have this podcast.
Oh, yeah, don't tell them.
Even on dates, I'm like, I'm not telling you the name of this podcast.
Definitely don't.
The idea that they could go in and learn about me freaks me out.
Completely. That's completely fair.
But if, yeah, okay. Okay, I am going to tell the story. Oh, wait, we should hold for sponsors in case we have them.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Shrug. Okay, I got this information from Wikipedia, and that's that. It was a really long article, but I know of this story from a musical, which I'm going to do a teaser. I got a new job. Do I tell you now? I'll tell you next episode. I got a new job opportunity that I'm really excited about, and I'll tell you next.
Is it going to take you out of New York?
I don't want to talk about it.
Okay.
Do I tell you now? Okay, I'll tell you what it is. So I got a call from my producers 2 weeks ago, and they were like, Carrie, we have this gig that we think you'd be perfect for. We're selling this show. We've sold it already. It's confirmed in these venues, but we don't have it written yet. And what it is it's called Sing Along Broadway.
Fun.
Quinn, I'm writing a sing along show for Broadway songs.
That's so fun.
Is that not perfect?
Yeah, you're going to love it. Where do you go?
It's only like a 2-week gig. It opens in Albuquerque. It goes to like Ontario. It might go to, I think it's going to like Connecticut, Pennsylvania. Like it's going all over, and it's random places, and they're just doing a trial run basically. So I think what they want to do is like write the show, do this like brief tour, test it out, and then sell it more.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm like really excited, and it was really fun to like, we sent out our one page to the agents, and I met this guy who, you would love this guy, you should know him, he does immersive shows for them, and he met me during Wheel of Fortune on a random rehearsal day, and we just got along very, very well. And then a year later he's like, yeah, let's do this show, what about that Carrie girl, and I got this job.
This is great.
Isn't that really exciting? I'm
Congrats.
Really, it's, thank you. It's been really fun listening to musicals because I really love them.
You love that homework.
It's such fun homework. And the show, like the games and the trivia, like all of it just like came out of me. And I was like, oh, I'm so prepared for this.
Yes.
So that was really fun.
You've been preparing your whole life without
knowing.
My whole life.
Except I can't bring it up on dates because it's immediately, they're like, oh, scary. They're like, you don't seem like a musical theater person. And I'm like, okay, I take that as a compliment?
Yes.
I don't know. Okay, so I got this mostly from Wikipedia. I want to tell you the story of Leo Frank. Do you know the story of Leo Frank?
I do not.
You should. It's pretty incredible. Leo Frank was born in 1884 in Texas. He quickly moved to New York. He then went to Cornell, where he got a degree in mechanical engineering. And then he moves to Atlanta in 1908, where he meets his future wife, Lucille Selig. Now, Lucille is from a very well-to-do, upper-middle-class Jewish family. In fact, 2 generations before her, her family founded the first synagogue in Atlanta.
Mm.
Pretty cool. The two of them get married in 1910, and Leo is very involved in the Jewish community in Atlanta. And they say the Jewish community in Atlanta at this time is the largest in the southern U.S.
Mm-hmm.
He becomes, through some like connection and family and his, you know, education, he becomes the director of the National Pencil Company. And now at this time, it's the early 1900s, there is anti-Semitism. In 1913, there is active child labor happening in all of these factories. And apparently some people are blaming that the factories are Jewish owned. Now, we can all agree, though, that child labor is not good. Okay? But I don't think this group of people created that problem. Okay?
Correct.
Just feel like we should say that.
Right.
One worker at this factory is 13-year-old Mary Fagan. Now, Mary Fagan began working in factories, in a textile factory, at the age of 10. And by 13, She's working at the National Pencil Factory, and her job was she was operating the machine that inserts the eraser into the metal tip mm-hmm. of the pencil, mm-hmm. and she earns 10 cents an hour, and she works 55 hours a week. Now, to put that in comparison, Leo, who's the director, makes $180 a month. She makes $5.50 a week. Where she works is right across from Leo's office. April 21st, 1913, she gets laid off because of a materials shortage. And a couple days later, 5 days later, she has to go pick up her last payment, her last check, essentially. And so she gets to the factory around noon on April 26th, and she never comes home. At that point, there is a night watchman named Newt Lee on call, and at 3 o'clock in the morning, he goes downstairs to use the bathroom in the basement, and he finds the body of Mary near the incinerator in the basement, and he immediately calls the police.
It's kind of crazy that a murder took place, and the guy's like, I'm not going to burn the body. I'll put it next to the incinerator mm-hmm. and put it on my to-do list. Like, I'm like, yeah. The balls. Like, really?
It's crazy. Now, she's covered in dirt, and so initially there's a question of, like, what she looks like. But she's this young white girl from Marietta, Georgia, and she was found with her dress around her waist with a strip of her petticoat ripped off of her skirt and wrapped around her neck. There's evidence of trauma to the head. There's scratches on her face. Her underwear is still pulled up around her hips, but it is stained with blood and torn open. In addition, there is a strip around her. There's a cord wrapped around her neck, and it's very tight, and it's very clear that she's died from strangulation. There is evidence of a struggle. They determine later that her time of death was between noon and 12:15. So feasibly, she went to get this check, and shortly after, she was murdered. They find that the service ramp at the rear of the basement leads to a door that opens to an alley, and this door had been tampered with so it could be easily opened without unlocking it. They find bloody fingerprints on the door. They find a metal pipe that was used as a crowbar. They see footprints and a trail from the elevator shaft, which is believed to have been where her body was dragged. They find blood and hair on the second floor of the factory, which is the same level as Leo Frank's office. Next to her body at the scene of the crime, they find two notes, and they look as though she wrote them, and they say the following. They said, he said, and this is all misspelled, he said he would love me, land down, play like the night witch did it, but that long, tall, black Negro boy did his sleff. The other note said, ma'am, that Negro higher down there did this. I went to make water, and he pushed me down that hole, a long, tall Negro, black, that who it was, long, slim, tall Negro. I write while play with me. So one of them says night witch, which they believe means the night watchman, which was Newt Lee. And so the police immediately suspect him that maybe he was the murderer, and he's arrested the following morning. They arrest one of Mary's friends, who they suspect. Mm-hmm. Immediately when they find the body, they call Leo, as he's the director of this factory. It's 4 o'clock in the morning, mm-hmm. and he's not answering. They finally get a hold of him at around 7 o'clock in the morning, and he agrees to accompany them to the factory. And when the police arrive at his house, without telling the specifics of what happened at the factory, the police note that Leo seems nervous, he's trembling, he's pale, his voice is hoarse, and he's rubbing his hands and asking questions before the police could answer. Mm-hmm. Now, Leo says that he's not familiar with the name of this young girl and would need to check the payroll book. The detectives then take him to the morgue to see her body, and mm-hmm. then to the factory where he views the crime scene and walks with the police through the entire building just to, like, see what's out of place.
Yeah.
He returns home at 10:45 in the morning, and at that point, Leo is not considered a suspect. It's not long after that the police don't think that Newt, the night watchman, did it, and they don't think that her friend did it. So the two of them are essentially released. But the mm-hmm. next day, Leo comes with his lawyer to the police, and he has written down a deposition of his timeline from the day of Mary's murder. So This is at a time where people don't know to lawyer up, but Leo is actively going with his lawyer, like trying to be above board. He says that Mary was in his office between 12:05 and 12:10, and then she left, and then his night watchman came at 4 o'clock in the evening, Newtley, but he was asked to return later, and then Leo had a confrontation with another ex-employee at like 6 o'clock in the evening. Leo left when Newt was arriving back. So it's like the timeline, he's just basically like, here is all I know about my whereabouts during the day.
Mm-hmm.
Leo notes that Newt's time card for Sunday morning has several gaps missing because he's supposed to punch in every half hour. And apparently Leo had missed this when he discussed the time card with the police on Sunday. And at his lawyer's insistence, Leo Frank goes to the police and exposes his whole body and shows that he has no cuts, no injuries.
Aggressive.
Really aggressive.
He's like, goes in naked. He's like, check this out.
But they find there's no blood on his suit. There is no blood stains on the laundry at his home.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's just going, here, I just need to make sure you know, above board, I have nothing to hide. He then goes on to hire the Pinkerton National Detective Agency, and he hires them in the case to make sure to prove his innocence. Now, This is very quickly after, but this detective agency, they're supposed to investigate any and all leads from the crime scene evidence to allegations of sexual misconduct that we'll talk about later from some of the workers in the factory on the part of Leo, and then they're required to submit duplicates of all this evidence to both the police, including any evidence that might hurt Leo's case.
Mm-hmm.
What Leo does not know is that one of the detectives that he hired has close ties with the police. Particularly, one of the guys is his best friend, is that lead detective John Black on the case, who from jump believes that Leo is guilty from the outset.
Okay.
So does that make sense? The next day, John Black then goes to Newt's home looking for evidence, and he sees a blood-smeared shirt at the bottom of a burn barrel. And he thinks it looks fishy because the blood was smeared high up in the armpits, and the shirt smelled like it was not used. It was totally clean. And he was like, I think this was planted here. And the detectives had noticed that Leo is very nervous throughout the interviews, and so they're like, oh, Leo totally planted that at Newt's house. So Leo is arrested for the murder just 3 days after her body is found. The police are convinced that Newt Lee was Leo's accomplice and that Leo was trying to implicate him in the crime. To help the case, the police stage a confrontation between Newt Lee and Leo Frank while they're both in custody. But there were conflicting accounts of this meeting, and so the police interpret it as further implicating Leo Frank as the murderer. Like, everything he's doing, they're just like, no, it's him. A young man comes forward and says that Mary had confided in him that Leo was maybe aggressive sexually, maybe he propositioned her, that he flirted with other girls. And there's also this guy, Jim Conley, who's the factory's janitor. He's arrested after he was seen washing red stains out of his blue work shirt. And then when the police looked at the shirt, they realized it was a rust stain. But when police interview him, he said on that day of the murder that he was visiting saloons, he was shooting dice, he was drinking. But his story is called into question when a witness tells detectives that they saw a black man dressed in dark blue clothing and hat near the lobby of the factory on the day of the murder. So there's an eyewitness that places him there on the day of the murder. So at this point, they're looking into Jim Conley, and they see that he can read and write, and there are similarities between his spelling and the note they found near Mary's body.
Okay.
And on May 24th...
Like, he writes gibberish.
I think he can read and write, but I don't think the spelling of it... You can see sort of like what... For example, they test him on his spelling, and they ask him to spell Night Watchman, and he spells it Night Witch, right? Like, he's the same inconsistencies in the letter match what he has. And he admitted on May 24th to writing the notes and swearing that Leo called him into his office on the day before the murder and told him to write them.
Mm-hmm.
Aw, poor baby. The police are skeptical about the rest of his story because it implies that Leo had premeditated this crime, and it seems like it was a crime of convenience, that it happened, you know, spur of the moment. But it also suggests that Leo had confessed to Jim Conley and involved him, but then Jim's story changes again. And in a new affidavit, which, by the way, this is his second affidavit, his third statement, he admits that he lied about this Friday meeting that happened before with Frank. Mm-hmm. And he said he actually met Frank on the street on Saturday. And he was told to follow him to the factory. And then Leo told him to hide in the wardrobe so that two women could not see him who were visiting Leo's office.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that Leo dictated the murder note for him to write, gave him cigarettes, and told him to leave the factory. And then afterwards, that's when he went out to the saloons and gambled and saw a movie. His story at this point, Jim's story, is that he did not know about the murder until he went in on that Monday.
Mm-hmm.
This story, like, the police are feeding all of this information to the press. So mm-hmm. the press is starting to go crazy. They're starting to come up with theories, and they're starting to publicly implicate people. Some people believe in the public that it's actually Jim Conley who killed her and that he followed her in the building to rob her, or to rob another employee into the building to rob them, but then found Mary and she was an easier target and she just had her pay, and her purse that she carries with her was never found.
Such little money.
Yeah, such little money. On May 28th, the police tried to get a meeting between Leo and Jim. Like, they tried to navigate that meeting between Newt and Leo. This mm-hmm. was between Leo and Jim. And Leo is like, I'm not fucking meeting with this guy without a lawyer present.
Mm-hmm.
And my lawyer's out of town. And the police see his refusal to meet with Jim as an indication of guilt.
Saying you won't take a lie detector.
Exactly. The next day, police interview Jim again for 4 hours. He signs a new affidavit saying that he picked up Mary's body, let her head fall, and hit her head against something. He also said that that Leo took the body to the basement via the elevator and then returned to Leo's office, that's where the murder notes were dictated. Then Jim hides in the wardrobe after they go to the office. He offers to give him $200, but then he takes it back, being like, let me give this to you after I'm okay on Monday if nothing happens. His affidavit ends with, the reason I have not told this before is I thought Mr. Frank would get out and help me out, and I decided to tell the whole truth about this matter. At trial, his story about the $200 changes, and he says that Leo withheld the money because he wanted Jim to burn Mary's body in the basement furnace near the incinerator. So again, like,
mm-hmm.
the big evidence they have, the big sort of like star evidence, is Jim's testimony at the mm-hmm. trial. They also, the prosecution manages to get stories from women at the factory who make accusations about Leo's sexual behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's worth noting that there are conflicting stories mm-hmm. in this, that, like, there are some people that are like, no, he was totally respectful. There are some people that were like, no, he was a creep. What's really challenging about this is obviously there's anti-Semitic sentiment happening in Georgia mm-hmm. at this time. And so Leo's attorney is like, it was Jim who did it. That's their assertion. They're like, it wasn't Leo Frank. It was Jim Conley. But both legal teams are planning their trial strategy, and they have to consider the implication that they're trying a Jewish white man based on the testimony of a black man in front of an early 1900s Georgia jury.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting about Jim Conley's lawyer is he's a very good attorney, and he had successfully defended another black man against an accusation of rape by a white woman, and he won. So he's a very good attorney. Conley testifies. He ends up getting 1 year in jail for being an accomplice after the fact to Mary's murder.
Mm-hmm.
Leo Frank's murder trial is underway, and the public is ravenous for justice for poor Mary Fagan, this young girl who was murdered horrifically, and they believe it is Leo Frank. And Leo Frank's attorney talks to the judge and says, when the verdict comes down, can we please not be in the court? Because if it is an acquittal, we are worried about our safety.
Mm-hmm.
If he gets off on this, we're worried there's going to be a lynch mob that's coming to get Leo Frank. August 25th, 1913, after 4 hours of deliberation, Leo Frank is found guilty and he is sentenced to death.
Wow.
His trial, his lawyers try to appeal, yet they are unsuccessful. There are certain, there's more evidence that comes to light after the fact. They find that the note that was dictated in Leo Frank's office, according to Jim Conley, was actually written downstairs in the basement, and they know that because the pad was down there and it never made its way upstairs. They find that the hair on the second floor doesn't match Mary Fagan's hair. They find that in the time of death that they think happened, that there was not enough time in Leo's schedule to kill her and move her body with who he saw throughout the day in that initial self-submitted deposition. So the governor at the time hears this information and he decides, you know what, I can't abide by this man's blood on my hands, so I'm going to commute his sentence from death by hanging to life imprisonment. He is, people are enraged. There is a massive uproar. And he says to the public, all I ask is that the people of Georgia read my statement and consider calmly the reasons I have given for commuting Leo M. Frank's sentence. Feeling as I do about the case, I would be a murderer if I allowed that man to hang. I would rather be plowing in a field than to feel for the rest of my life that I had that man's blood on my hands. He also told reporters that he was certain that Jim Conley was the actual murderer, and that he also told friends that he would have issued a full pardon if not for the belief that Frank, that Leo, would soon be able to be to prove his own innocence. Obviously, there was a massive amount of outrage that he was not going to be hanged. Leo Frank was then moved to another prison for his safety, where at that prison, another prisoner slashed his throat with a 7-inch butcher knife, and he survives it. And the prisoner went on record to be like, I would do it again because I want to save my inmates from mob, my other inmates from mob violence. At this point, the family and loved ones of Mary Fagan are livid. They do not believe justice is served, even if this man is serving life in prison. They believe that he should be put to death. Mm-hmm. And a group of prominent men in the hometown of Mary Fagan, they organize themselves into a group called the Vigilance Committee, and they openly plan to kidnap Leo Frank from prison. This is 28 men who have different skills to help. There's electricians, there's car mechanics, there's locksmiths, there's a telephone guy, There's a hangman, a medic, a preacher. And these people were all known locally by the community. And spoiler alert, the names will not be revealed until June 2000, when a local librarian posts a list on the web, which is based on Mary Fagan's great niece.
Mm-hmm.
It's August 16th, 1915. 8 cars leave Marietta, Georgia, and it's a 7-hour drive to the prison. They get to the prison at 10 o'clock at night. They cut the telephone wires. They drain all the cars of gas. They handcuff the warden, and they take Leo Frank, and they drive the 7 hours at the top speed of 18 miles per hour. It's the early 1900s. People aren't driving fast. He is hung on a tree facing Mary Fagan's home at 7 o'clock in the morning in her hometown. At this point, people are taking photos in front of his body. They take his body down. People are clamoring to see his body. They believe 15,000 people looked on his body. He was transported to Queens, where he is buried here in New York. The photographs of the lynching were sold for 25 cents each.
What?
They also sold pieces of the rope used, his nightshirt, branches from the tree. Nobody was charged with the lynching. After his lynching, around half of Georgia's 3,000 Jewish people left the state. Author Steve Oney says, what it did to Southern Jews can't be discounted. It drove them into a state of denial about their Judaism. The temple did away with chuppahs at weddings, anything that would draw attention. This obviously had a massive effect on the political climate, obviously. It's 1986, and the Georgia State Board of Pardons and Paroles issued a pardon to recognize the state's failure, including to protect Leo Frank in prison and preserve his opportunity to appeal. But they took no stance on his innocence or guilt. Mm-hmm. The African-American press at the time condemned the lynching, but many African-Americans also oppose Leo Frank and those who support him because they believe in Jim Conley's innocence and that he was mischaracterized as a black man. The case created the Anti-Defamation League. It mm-hmm. was a part of the reason that exists, but it also affected the resurgence of the KKK. So it had lasting repercussions, and it still does to this day. In modern times, it said that despite strong evidence to Leo Frank being innocent, this case has become a focal point for neo-Nazis and anti-Semites, and that is partly because it helped spur the creation to the Anti-Defamation League, and also because it fed into anti-Semitic conspiracy theories. In recent years, there's been a number of websites that have been established by white supremacists who have disputed the prevailing consensus of Leo Frank's innocence. On the 100th year anniversary of the trial, the Anti-Defamation League issued a press release condemning what it called misleading websites from anti-Semites to promote anti-Jewish views. I wanted to cover this case because this is also the basis of the musical Parade, which is based on Leo Frank's life, and the music is incredible. It's Jason Robert Brown.
What song are you going to use for the Broadway?
I don't think we're going to use this one for the Broadway, but there's an incredible song. The prologue is amazing. I think it's The Hills of Georgia, but You Don't Know This Man is a really beautiful song that his wife sings in the show. But yeah, I think in this, yeah, I wanted to share this story because I think it's a story we probably should know.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
So that's I definitely didn't know it. Twists and turns. What a story.
I mean, the consensus is
that... Where'd you find it?
Wikipedia.
Yeah, but, like, it's not like you browse Wikipedia, so, like,
Well, I knew this story because I know Parade.
Oh,
but I didn't know. It's based on the musical. The musical is based on his life and this, and, you know, it's heartbreaking, right? Because there's this man who was lynched, this poor young girl was murdered, and I don't know if justice was served in that case. And it's also from the early 1900s, so there's like not the consensus is that Leo Frank died an innocent man, and that anti-Semitism and bias against him led him to his wrongful conviction.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's a heavy one.
Yeah. I got this story from the New York Times, USA Today, Law and Crime, CBNW by Alexandra Williams, and yes, that's what I did. This guy, Umar Abdullah, moves in an apartment with his pregnant wife, and they meet the neighbors, and their upstairs neighbor is a PhD student at the nearby University of South Florida. His name is Juming Lee. And they meet and, like, Juming Lee has a family. He's married. He has two small kids. So they're like, oh, we're going to have a kid. And the guy is really nice. And after their daughter is born, Lee gives the Abdullahs a gift, like a little dress for her. So far, so good. But after the baby is born, Lee starts complaining to them about loud noises. And they're like, oh, well, we have a newborn. Like, she's crying a lot because she's a baby. And he's like, no, it's lean furniture. It's banging. It's vacuuming. It seems like you slam the toilet lid. And I can hear everything. I can hear when you open and close drawers. And they're like, yeah, but we're closing the toilet. We're closing a drawer. Like,
we're existing.
We can't not make that noise. We're going to really do our best. We're sorry it's bothering you. So they put in like more carpeting. They start wearing slippers around the house. They're really trying to make it work with this guy. And they're apologizing all the time. But Lee just keeps filing complaints with the board. And then the association, the condo association or whatever, is like, sir, it's a family residence. There's a lot of people that live here. It doesn't sound like they're doing anything crazy. It's just noise. They can't do anything about it. Please try to be a good neighbor. On May 31st, Umar Abdullah is not home, and he calls a friend and asks, can you go by my house to get a delivery and like bring it inside the apartment? And she's like, sure. So she goes to bring this package inside, and she is hit by the craziest smell when she walks into the apartment. So she calls Umar and she's like, did you just paint? And he's like, no. And she's like, it smells insane in here. It's so chemical. It's so gross. My eyes are burning. I gotta go. It feels like somebody put chili powder on my face. This is awful. And it seems like it's like coming maybe from your hot water heater. You got to get this checked out. This is nuts. She leaves. He gets home and it's not so bad, but it does start to return here and there. It's like it comes in waves and it makes it really hard to breathe. And it feels like, ow, 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 someone's poking you in the eye. So anytime it happens, they just open all the windows and are like, what the fuck? And their baby is being completely affected. She's coughing when it happens. She's throwing up. And this is a new little baby, not even a year old. So they're freaked out and they're like, we have to figure out what's causing this. Let's call Tampa Fire Rescue and see if there's a chemical leak. And they come and they're like, oh my God, it's terrible in here, but no, there's no chemical leak. And they're like, God, maybe it's like one of our appliances or something. So they have a repair guy come check out the air conditioner. And he's also really uncomfortable while he's checking it out, but he can't find anything. They have a plumber come look at the hot water heater who gets lightheaded and nauseous while he's in their apartment, but agrees like, this is not your hot water heater. They just keep calling people in. And the fire department, when they come, are like, yeah, like something is making our eyes water. But if it's not a leak and it's not the AC and it's not the hot water heater, they're just running out of ideas. And as this is all happening, Lee is continuing to complain and be a dick to them. And they're like, "If could it be related? Like, it feels really intense that this guy is so unhinged about complaining about us. And then this weird thing is happening. Let's put a security camera, sneaky style, in the hallway and just see." And they put one outside, and almost right away, it picks up Lee standing outside their door, and he goes and kneels down, gets out some sort of needle or syringe, and then he gets a call and he stands up and walks away really quickly. But then he comes back and he does this like thing outside the door where it looks like he's putting the syringe. You can watch the videotape. It's accessible online. He's like putting the syringe under the door and pressing the thing down. And they don't know what it could be, but they catch him doing it twice in a matter of days. And they're like, this is crazy. Let's bring this videotape that we got to the police. So they bring it to the police, and meanwhile they like have nowhere to go really, so they're in their apartment and waiting for tests to come through and try to identify the air, essentially what is in the air. And they're terrified because they don't know what it is, and their baby, who is developing, has been exposed to whatever it is. They do preliminary testing, hazmat testing, and they find methadone and hydrocodone with opioids in the air. And they start doing more testing, but one of the officers gets exposed somehow accidentally and gets his skin is really irritated instantly, and he has to get treatment. So it's very serious, but They don't know what it is. There's a medical toxicologist who says it's the methadone isn't the issue because a lot of people have things that have methadone in their homes. They don't have adverse effects. There's something else being mixed into this that would be the thing causing these symptoms that you guys are saying you're having. And I know I said this at the beginning, but again, Lee is a PhD student in chemistry and he has access to University of South Florida's lab.
Yeah.
So it's not totally known how he used the compounds of methadone and hydrocodone, but it seems like somehow working in the lab, he might have been able to synthesize chemical agents and then inject them into the home to cause harm. And this calls to attention that schools have a lot of rules in these labs, but like they say you shouldn't be working alone and there's all these kinds of things, but they don't do as much tracking as they could do, like key card access where they can like who went into what when, and they do a lot of paper reporting, like old school, like library, like I'm signing this out. And so since this case happened, which is super recent, everybody's like, this is this year, you know? So everybody's like, what should we be doing to make sure people that are in these positions as students don't just have free rein and access, because this is crazy and it's not the only time it's happened. There have been cases of people, students specifically, using labs to cause harm. And the examples they gave in one of the articles was that in 2014, there was a student at Stanford that poisoned a bunch of people's water bottles with paraformaldehyde. And in 2021, a student in Germany stole a bunch of bromelanine from a lab and poisoned people with that. So it's like we can't just be letting these chemicals be accessible because we don't know what's like the stability of these people. Again, it reminded me of that case that I love to talk about, of that horrible neighbor that poisoned the Coke.
Or what is it?
Yeah,
I remember. That's such a crazy story.
Well, so
do they know what it was?
This all just went down this summer. Like, so whoa. Lee got arrested in June. He pled not guilty.
It's so crazy. He's like, he's in the fucking hall. Tape,
yeah.
On tape.
Well, it's even funny. The articles are like, and the articles are so careful. They're like, a man that appears to be Lee. Like, you're like, yeah, it's him. Like,
listen, we did for a moment.
A man in a Lee mask. Like,
have you seen Mission Impossible? Could have been that. Could have been just a human mask.
So, like, totally. It's probably Tom Cruise.
It's definitely Tom Cruise.
So he gets charged with battery, aggravated stalking, possession of a controlled substance, and he's released just 2 days later on bond, and he's supposed to go to court this December, and his lawyer's like, all the facts are going to become whatever. Or all the facts will come out.
I was helping the family.
Well, this is really interesting. After he got arrested, they're like, you were on a student visa, so it's a strong no. And ICE deports him before the hearing. So what that means is that the judge then issued a capias warrant, which means that if he ever tries to enter the country again, the charges would be brought against him again. But he just left the country. He got deported. And so
that's... Was any justice served?
I don't know. scary because I'm like, I just don't like that this guy's walking around somewhere else now. It's like, it's such a like, now it's somebody else's problem.
Well, and it's like our current administration's like point, like
that's sort of why I wanted to talk about it. I was like, this is so timely considering everything that's going on with ICE right now. But
but now there's like no depth, like they can't, the poor family can't be like, what were you using? What there's so much stuff in discovery that they could have totally tried to like.
I think it's also more to the point that I don't think it gives him, it's a big consequence. He got expelled and deported, but he's just now walking the streets and whoever pisses him off next. What can he get his hands on there? I don't know the answer. It's just, it's like this kind of person that is like, I'm mad at you because you're shutting drawers, so I poison a newborn. This is not normal.
Is the newborn okay? Was there anything about...
I mean, the newborn's okay. I don't think that, like, in the news, so I couldn't find scary. Anything. Because I feel it's such a recent thing that it feels like in the news, it's just very much like, we don't know what's going to happen. We just know that this happened. This was like, wild. And watching the video was so scary, where you're like, here's this guy just kneeling in a hallway who has access to them that's doing this completely scary thing.
It's also really scary, too, to be like, if by using those like synthesized opioids, right, in the air, like if there was like a random check on that family and they found that there, like they could have had their kid taken away. There's so many consequences to that are just like so scary and sad and ugh.
Yeah.
People, man.
People are the worst.
People suck. What am I doing trying to date?
Trying to meet one. Careful.
What the fuck am I doing?
Just be careful out there.
Okay, we'll end it here. Goodbye.
Be right back.